Sally, as I understand it, when you started reporting on what's been called the European migrant crisis, it was back in 2015, I think, or thereabouts, and you were working for Vice at the time. How did it all start? What triggered you starting to report on that particular issue?
Yeah, and thank you for having me. Yeah, I wouldn't say that it was necessarily triggered. Well, like, I was working for Vice as a staff writer and basically covered, like, everything outside of America. So I was, like, the only staff writer for Vice News in the London office. So I basically just covered whatever was happening at the time. And, yeah, there was, like, kind of various, pieces of news coming through regarding migration, particularly, like, shipwrecks, things like that. And so I'd cover them initially from the desk. And then I was kind of aching, as all, young reporters are, to get out and actually be meeting people and doing actual reporting that wasn't just, like, sitting somewhere and phoning people. And in 2015, I'm sure everyone will remember, David Cameron, I think, was Prime Minister at the time, and said that there were swarms of migrants in Calais who were trying to get over to reach the UK. And basically, that was kind of a moment where my editor went, what does that even mean? Like, who are we talking about here? Who are these people? Why are they trying to get here? What's going on? And I was like, this is my chance, please just send me and I'll go, I'll figure out what's going on. And I actually, Vice had given me like 1,000 business cards, which I hadn't really had the chance to use because I wasn't really allowed to leave my desk. So I went out to Calais with like a big stack of business cards. And basically everybody I met, I was like, stay in touch, take my details. Let me know if you reach the UK. Tell me, let me know if there's anything you think we should be covering. It was handy because a lot of them actually knew of Vice at the time as well, because we had been doing a lot of coverage of various regions where people were fleeing from. And that was kind of my first, first of all, my first understanding that what we see in the news, and particularly in political soundbites, is not necessarily reflective of the reality. What I found in Calais was like a lot of people who had escaped from like a huge amount of different situations, who didn't even necessarily have that much in common with each other, and had so many different reasons for trying to get to the UK and had no legal way of getting there. And for me, that was also like, I think that the way it had been portrayed, it just wasn't getting across the actual reality of this situation. And also the kind of games that were being played regarding like how borders are erected, and how, one thing that at the time anyway, I found kind of interesting was like the role that journalists were playing as well, that basically we'd turn up. Actually, the French police were happy to let people go through, but they were like, if the journalists are here watching us, we don't want to do that. So while the journalists were present, the French police would be cracking down on the situation. And then once we disappeared, like all the refugees, migrants would be like, once you guys go, they're going to let us through. So like, can you just get your information and leave, basically? But
Sally, can you say a bit about, you say there are many different reasons why people finding themselves in Calais. What sorts of reasons?
I mean, everything, like dictatorships, persecution. There were like people who were gay who were fleeing kind of places where they, they felt their lives were at danger, or their lives were in danger. And also like extreme poverty. A family might have all clubbed together and just funded one person to be able to get to a rich country where they could send back money to help the family. And yeah, like many situations.
And you've documented in your book and reported on the routes that converge, certainly on the southern Mediterranean shores at Libya, coming up through Central and East Africa. Could you just say, could we have, the map, if we've got it? I just wondered if you could say a bit about the route, for instance, from... Because we here we'll watch... This is something that will emerge in our conversation. We'll watch footage of people crossing the Mediterranean, as though that's the entirety of the challenge and the issue. But the journey predates that and extends prior to that considerably.
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning the book. I should say I'm very anxious about talking in front of this esteemed audience, and I also am always very conscious that what I can say vocally is like not like It's only a tiny amount of what is in the book. It's said much better in the book. Please, everyone, consider reading it. It's called My Fourth Time We Drowned, and it's for sale outside. That was one thing, again, that surprised me. So the book starts with a Facebook message, and basically I had started reporting on this, like I said, handing out business cards, staying in touch with people, started doing a bit of investigative work into kind of refugees trying to return to Syria, and then in Sudan as well, into corruption within the UN Refugee Agency resettlement scheme. And kind of as a result of that, but I didn't realize this at the time, I got a Facebook message out of nowhere that came in 2018 in August, and it said, "Hi, Sister Sally, we need your help. We're under bad condition in Libya prison. If you have time, I'll tell you all the story." And that is the beginning of what ended up being like years of work documenting what is happening to people who try and leave North Africa to get to Europe. And yeah, like a lot of what I was finding out shocked me. You know, I wasn't going out of my way to I didn't know I was writing a book, but I wasn't going out of my way to, you know, tell the stories of refugees or whatever. But I was actually very shocked by the different roles that the West was playing in these systems, and also how everything is being misunderstood and how people's voices that are actually experiencing these things are being silenced, and how that's leading to, you know, quite shocking abuses. And so, yeah, a lot of that is documented in the book, the routes that people take. The sea is actually an escape route. So the sea generally comes after years of torture and abuse. And the sea is the point when you actually get a chance to kind of escape a cycle of exploitation. And that's what I hadn't realized. I think a lot of people think the sea is the journey. They're like, oh, that must be the journey that they're taking. No, the sea is like their one chance to get out of this cycle. And yeah, it can come after years.
I think what's extraordinary to me, and it should, we've talked about this, why it shouldn't be extraordinary to me, but it was nonetheless, was that on arrival at the sea and an attempt to cross the Mediterranean, although there are European patrols looking out for migrants on boats, the response, as I understand it, and I'd be grateful for you to clarify for me, isn't necessarily to then take those boats and rescue them. But there's an agreement now with this, or has been an agreement for some years with Libya?
Yeah, it's not necessarily correct to say that there are European patrols looking out. Actually, Europe has stopped its kind of naval mission in the sea looking out for migrants and refugees. So what is happening is a deliberate circumnavigation of international law, and this is what I realized quite quickly. What you have is a situation since 2017 where people, men, women, and children, are trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. So the central Mediterranean between Libya and sometimes Tunisia and then Malta or Italy. That's the central Mediterranean. It's called by the UN the deadliest migration route in the world. Nearly, I think 21,200 people are known to have or are estimated to have died there since 2014, but the statistics are probably much higher because a lot isn't being documented. And what has been happening since 2017 is basically that Europe is conducting surveillance, so they're flying drones, helicopters, planes to spot refugee boats, but they're also supporting the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept those boats and force people back to Libya. And once they're brought back to Libya, they're often locked up indefinitely in detention centers that Pope Francis, among others, has compared to concentration camps. And that, I think I just did the figures on the latest number of documented interceptions. It's 117,000 since 2017, since this policy started. And this policy is a circumnavigation because a European vessel cannot return somebody to Libya because their lives will be in danger, but a Libyan vessel can. And I mean, I think I wrote the book in the prologue, I say, like, I hope it plays some role in the quest for accountability. Basically, what I realized is that Europe is not, I would say deliberately, but I mean, they might not say that, but they say they were not documenting what happened to people after that point of interception. And I was like, I want to document the consequences of this policy. You know, how many people die when they return to Libya, for example? And since the book has been published, it has been cited in a submission to the International Criminal Court calling for named EU officials to be charged with crimes against humanity.
The European actions there directly facilitate the return of migrants to Libya. And thereafter, there's no European jurisdiction on what happens. And the detention camps, which you elaborate in some depth in the book, the landscape within them is horrific, and often for years. Can you say a bit about the camps?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're not camps, they're like detention centers, they're basically prisons, but people don't have a lawyer, you know, you're not actually charged with anything, you're just locked up indefinitely, you don't have, you know, any way to challenge that. And basically the book was born out of, first I got that first Facebook message, and I started communicating with this one group of people. The first person who messaged me was from Eritrea. He was with roughly 500 men, women, and children. They were in the middle of a war zone. They'd been left without food or water. They had been abandoned by the guards because of the war that had just broken out. And they were basically like, we're in a life or death situation. We desperately need help. And this message came through to me. I was in London. Like, I was like, is this real? You know, I don't know how this has happened, but started looking into it. After about 24 hours, I had verified that it was definitely true. I'd contacted a lot of NGOs, the UN, trying to get help for them. Help didn't come, and the people I was in touch with were like, just do anything, just make this public. So I started posting the messages on Twitter, and I started a Twitter thread that actually went on for years. It ended up getting millions of views, so I guess it went viral. And the result of that, which I didn't anticipate, was that I was thinking, I just need to get help for this one group of people. You know, and even then I was like, I'm a journalist. Normally this is not what I do, but in this situation, you know, this is what I'm doing. And I was like, I'll just get help for them. This must be like an isolated incident, you know, an accidental oversight. And once they're helped, something will change. And instead, it turned out that there were many of these detention centers, thousands of people locked up, and my contact details were passed around many, many different detention centers. So suddenly I was fielding like contacts and information from many, many different places, and the phones were prohibited. So it's like people with hidden phones who are literally risking their lives to send you this information. And I ended up in touch with people for years, inside many different detention centers, basically just on a daily basis documenting what was happening there and often sending that information on to NGOs that I hoped could help. And so honestly, like, what's in the book is like the tip of the iceberg in terms of what I received. And what I received is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the actual scale of this situation. And yeah, sorry, I don't know, did that answer well?
No, it did. When you say that there are no legal routes, this is a really naive question. So there are no legal routes. Large amounts of money go in towards people getting, human beings getting from Eastern Africa up to the Mediterranean. So the absence of a legal route isn't predicated primarily on the absence of funding, because funding is somehow, through means that are awful often, sought. What makes the route illegal?
So this is like a good question, and basically when we talk about legal routes, I think we mean, I mean, yeah, illegal always depends on who's speaking, right, or who's making the rules, but like generally when you hear kind of British politicians, for example, say, you know, queue skippers or whatever, like people are jumping the queue, it's like very hard sometimes to understand what they're speaking about, because the kind of way that you would actually seek safety by like getting on a plane or something, that requires you to have a visa or to have some sort of permission to travel. And like the chance of you getting that is basically nothing. There are very, very limited refugee resettlement routes, and there's a kind of global program called the Refugee Resettlement Program. It's reliant on rich countries or safe countries offering spaces, and the number of spaces that they offer are so limited that, you know, sometimes it barely means anything. And actually, like I said, so the way that I ended up getting contacted first by those people in Libya, and I didn't know this at the time, was because I had done a big investigation into, you can see Sudan is beside Libya, and so a lot of refugees escaping, particularly Somalia, Ethiopia, and Eritrea, end up in Sudan. And a lot of them do try and get this refugee resettlement through the UN Refugee Agency. And I had gone there in 2017, and I had been reporting on something else. But I was meeting refugees, and they were all like, don't report on that other thing, like report on corruption within the resettlement process. And what they were telling me was that refugees were being charged up to around $20,000 to be given the opportunity to move to a safe country through the, you know, the legal route. And so I did an investigation into that. 2 days after it was published, UNHCR suspended their resettlement program nationwide, carried out an anti-fraud investigation, and they found one staff member guilty of soliciting bribes and abusing power. Refugees say that that problem is ongoing and you know, much more widespread. And a UN, a former UN investigator that I interviewed, who had uncovered a kind of similar scheme in Kenya a long time before, he said that actually, when you have like such tiny supply and such huge demand, there's always going to be scope for like exploitation and abuse, and you know, particularly in a system that's not very transparent. And so, yeah, like I think that also challenged my idea of, you know, what does it mean to be waiting for, yes, you know, these tiny number of opportunities that are just not available to most people. And even if you have no trust in that system, like people who are in Sudan, they'd be like, you know, we could pay 20 grand to go through the UN, or we could pay 5 grand to go through Libya. So like, which is better for us in this situation? And also, yeah.
I don't know. Opens it up. So the 5 grand option opens up, of course, the opportunity for smugglers and traffickers, which here are the very easy individuals to demonize in all of this, you know, and villainize and criminalize. Your encounters, I sense, both recognize the horror of their actions, but did you almost arrive at a version of understanding and sympathy for them as part as being almost as much a victim in the entire setup?
No, I wouldn't go that far. But I would say that I think smugglers, generally people, smugglers are serving a need. You know, there'll always be, you know, they talk about breaking the business models, people smugglers. When you make it harder to cross into a safe country, you empower them and you make their business easier, because people are always going to try and find a way to cross. But I do think that one thing that I documented, which again, I didn't anticipate initially, I was like, I'm just going to document what's happening in the government, you know, the Libyan government associated detention centers. But after that, I realized that actually there's a link between them, the smugglers and traffickers, and the Libyan Coast Guard. And this has been documented since by a UN independent fact-finding mission, who have said, you know, it's not so clear, like all of these groups work together, basically. But the smugglers and traffickers, like what was happening was that because people are now getting caught at sea, I mean, the title of the book is My Fourth Time We Drowned. That's a person who tried to cross, you know, 4 times and basically got forced back the first 3 times. And what is happening is that because the smugglers and traffickers then realize, like, you know, they're being sent back basically to the smugglers and traffickers. So the only way to get out of detention often is to pay the guards to let you go back to a smuggler or trafficker. And the smugglers and traffickers also began selling people between each other and holding them for ransom and charging more and more money for them. And in the afterword of the paperback, I document this. I actually attended the trials of 2 of the like highly significant traffickers, smugglers in Libya. I mean, they got arrested in Ethiopia, and I ended up at the trial, and I was the only like independent person there besides the guy who was translating for me. So there was no one from an embassy, no one from a human rights group, nobody from the UN. And that really showed me that all this rhetoric about, you know, tackling smugglers and traffickers, a lot of the time it feels quite empty, because in that case, victims were risking their lives again to testify against these men, and one of them ended up escaping prison. Since the book got published, out of the two, the one who escaped has been rearrested, and the one who was in Ethiopia has been extradited to the Netherlands. And I know again that the Netherlands prosecutors have been using their reporting. So for me, that it kind of shows the importance of covering this stuff. But yeah,
you've been reporting on humanitarian crises, conflict for a long period of time. Are you surprised by European actions in this context? Were you astonished at to discover how this was playing out, or did it just feel?
I think the shocking part for me was that I don't know if this sounds bad, but like that I hadn't cared as much as I should have before, because I had kind of heard vaguely about this policy, but I didn't realize the human implications of it. And I mean, I'm Irish, like we're still in the EU, but like even in UK, like, you know, in a way, this is being done in our name. Like these policies are being enacted to keep us, you know, in a comfortable position. And maybe it's only once you have direct communication with somebody who's a victim of them that you can really see, like, the devastation that that is causing, and also the lack of documentation, the kind of silencing that's happening. But it shouldn't be, like, down to, you know, every refugee or migrant who's trying to make one of these journeys to have to contact a European to tell them, like, that they're a human as well, you know? Like, that's also awful. But yeah, I think for me, like, what propelled me through those years of just reporting this, like, every day was my shock that I hadn't personally even cared so much.
I just wonder, my experience sometimes is I'm very conscious of turning away from some of this, these events on happening to other human beings on our planet all the time. And after reading what you've written, I've just found myself wondering what it is that makes us turn away. Is it a fear of complicity? Is it shame? Is it powerlessness? Is it just straightforward apathy? Have you got a sense of what makes us not engage and turn away?
Yeah, I don't think that I can personally answer that fully, but I do think that, you know, even listening to speakers earlier, maybe there's like a moment of shock that needs to happen for people to remember that they're supposed to be paying attention or that they're supposed to care. And yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, not that I personally will be that, but like that those happen for lots of people, because why has this become normalized? You know, it's shocking that people are dying every day trying to make these journeys, and it's become normalized, and that there's not proper calls for accountability or calls even to understand like how money is being spent, the impact of policies, how many people are dying because of those policies, and the long-term ramifications are, I think, going to be quite devastating. I mean, we don't have time to go into it now, but like, yeah, this is like, you know, things are getting worse and worse.
And to close, what do you see, such as it is, your duty then as a reporter? What motivates you to report?
I mean, I'm always trying to document things that I guess aren't properly being documented. It's been really tricky for me, like working on this book, publicizing this book, getting asked to speak about it, because as a journalist, you really have to be a bit careful that you're not becoming an advocate or like an activist. You're not advocating for certain policies because that can impede your ability to be able to keep working. And so my goal has just been that people can't say they don't know about this anymore. And I think hopefully it's at least doing a little bit. And you guys here today, everybody like listening, you having me at this event, that's, you know, that means something. So I'm grateful.
I mean, I can say with some, and I don't think I ever do this at Medicine on Box, but everybody ought to read this book out of almost a moral obligation. And thank you.
And to say for the doctors in the audience, there's also medical. Medical parts.
Thank you, Sally Hayden.